Welcome to Poetry and Everything. I'm Judith Arcana, the show's host. Each month, we'll have guests who are Portland poets, nearby poets, maybe even some faraway poets, pairs of poets, groups of poets. Sometimes I'm thinking maybe we'll have people who are not poets, but everybody is going to be reading and talking about poetry and everything. Each time, we'll open with me reading a bit of my own work, and then the guest and I will read work by other poets, not ourselves. That'll be the opening of every show, including this one. So I'll start this one off with a poem. I wrote this a few years back. It was published sometime then, but it rose to the top of my mind because this is the election season. This poem is called Eye Action, and the I is like the I in iPhone, the tiny little italic I. Eye Action. We sprayed graffiti on our Facebook walls, tweeted outrage to the websites of senators, marched around our living rooms with we, zapped cyber petitions to the Pentagon. Some of us phoned in flash mobs. Lots of us taped everything for YouTube. We were virtually unstoppable. Actually, though, some of us did hit the pause button. When sidewalk time came, hitting the asphalt, fault lines opened up along the edges of our keyboards, striking letters into questions older units used to ask, like, to be or not to be. You know that one? Whether to take arms against a sea of troubles and by opposing end them? Question is there, I mean, like now, an app for that? I had to do it, folks. All right. So I want to introduce tonight's guest before we read other folks' work with each other and to you. Tonight's guest is Judith Barrington. Welcome, Judith Barrington.
Thank you for having me. I'm glad to be here.
I'm glad you're here, too. I want to tell you a few things. Judith Barrington was born in Brighton, England, during Germany's intense World War II bombing of that country in the summer of 1944. She moved to the United States in 1976 and has lived since then in Portland, Oregon. Judith is the author of four poetry collections, two poetry chapbooks, a prize-winning memoir, and a book about writing memoir. Now a classic, actually, used in MFA programs, etc., workshops across the land and, indeed, in other lands. Her work is in many anthologies and many literary journals, both in print and online. She was for several years on the faculty of the MFA program in creative writing at the University of Alaska in Anchorage, and has taught creative writing in many other places as well, universities, workshops, festivals, both here and in Europe. In 2013, Judith was awarded the Gregory O'Donoghue International Poetry Prize and read at the Cork Spring Poetry Festival in Ireland. Also, Judith has been what I'm going to call a literary organizer. With her partner, Ruth Gundel, she is a founder of the Flight of the Mind Writing Workshops, which provided 2 week-long writing sessions for women on the Mackenzie River for 17 years. That's a lot of women and a lot of writing. And also with Ruth, Judith is a founder of Soapstone, which continues to serve women writers in its newest incarnation. So, Judith, there you are in the official introduction.
I don't know if I can live up to it.
Oh, I suspect you will. So now, let's read poems written by other people. What have you got?
Well, I'm having a moment of really wanting to revive Judy Gran.
And I'm what a good idea.
Even considering maybe doing a study group about Judy Gran. I think Judy Gran is a very important poet and was in the mid-70s when I came across her. Very political, very feminist. She was part of the feminist arts poet movement, with along with Adrienne Rich, Audre Lorde, all those people we know, Pat Parker. And of course, she's still around and still writing and still reading. But I don't think that the younger feminists know what a groundbreaking person she was for us, and for me particularly as a poet. So I thought that I would introduce people who don't know her to a sequence of poems that she wrote, which was possibly one of the two most famous. One was, this one is the work of a common woman, the common mm-hmm. woman poems. Mm-hmm. Also, A Woman is Talking to Death was one of her other really great ones. And there were others that I loved too. But the common woman poems, there are, let me see, six of them. Am I saying that right? I think so.
Sounds right. Close, anyway.
Seven of them, actually. Okay. But I'm only going to read two of them because that seems right.
Yeah.
And they're all, each one is about a different woman, a real character who she creates, but from a totally different place in life, a socioeconomic and just generally a different kind of woman every time. And I'm going to read you first number four, which is called Carol in the Park Chewing on Straws. She has taken a woman lover. Whatever shall we do? She has taken a woman lover. How lucky it wasn't you. And all the day through she smiles and lies and grits her teeth and pretends to be shy or weak or busy. Then she goes home and pounds her own nails, makes her own bets, and fixes her own car with her friend. She goes as far as women can go without protection from men. On weekends, she dreams of becoming a tree that dreams it is ground up and sent to the paper factory, where it lies helpless in sheets until it dreams of becoming a paper airplane and rises on its own current, where it turns into a bird, a great coasting bird that dreams of becoming more free even than that, a feather, finally, or a piece of air with lightning in it. She has taken a woman lover. Whatever can we say? She walks around all day quietly, but underneath it, she's electric, angry energy inside a passive form. The common woman is as common as a thunderstorm. Each one ends with a different common woman line.
Yes, I remember so well.
Yeah, I love them, all of them, actually. I wish I could read them all. So the other one that I would like to read is number seven. This is the last in the sequence, which is called Vera from My Childhood. Solemnly swearing to swear as an oath to you who have somehow gotten to be a pale old woman. Swearing as if an oath could be wrapped around your shoulders like a new coat. For your $28 a week and the bastard boss you never let yourself hate. And the work, all the work you did at home where you never got paid. For your mouth that got thinner and thinner until it disappeared as if you had choked on it, watching the hard liquor break your fine husband down into a dead joke. For the strange mole, like a third eye right in the middle of your forehead. For your religion, which insisted that people are beautiful golden birds and must be preserved. For your persistent nerve and plain white talk. The common woman is as common as good bread, as common as when you couldn't go on, but did. For all the world we didn't know we held in common. All along, the common woman is as common as the best of bread and will rise and will become strong. I swear it to you. I swear it to you on my own head. I swear it to you on my common woman's head.
The rising bread image. Yeah. I remember when I first read it, I thought, oh, this is brilliant.
It was brilliant. And it was made into a poster. I remember that a lot of people I knew back in the late 70s had that poster on their wall. Woman is a common loaf of bread.
And will rise. Yes. All right. Well, and now for something completely different, as they say, as we now all say, I have Two Tiny Ones by Gregory Orr.
Oh, I love Gregory.
Yes, he's so good. We're lucky that we have him.
Which book is this from?
It's a tiny piece of Ode to Words, and the other is part of Ode to Some Lyric Poets. Uh-huh. So here's the excerpt from Ode to Words, Part 7. The word also, how it seems to know we want more, need more, that our greed is, in some sense, inexhaustible. How it senses we'll never get enough of poems and songs or the body of the beloved, not to mention the world, how much we crave it, the world also. Yeah, he's got it. Okay,
he's good.
This is a tiny piece of another long, many-sectioned piece called Ode to Some Lyric Poets. Always, the beloved is dying. Always, rampant violence. Yet, always, the soul resists. And part of this is someone somewhere writing a poem. And someone else waiting, sometimes for centuries, to read it. Someone who needs it so as not to yield to despair.
That's lovely.
Yeah.
He's great. Have you read his memoir?
I have read the Blessing. About the early. Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's brilliant.
And other. And he publishes articles often in Poetry Mags. Yeah. We're lucky that he keeps on doing it.
Orpheus and Eurydice poems.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. So, for those of you who have just joined us, this is KBOO, Community Radio in Portland, Oregon. And this show is Poetry and Everything. Tonight's guest is Judith Barrington. I'm your host, Judith Arcana. And now, our guest is going to read to us. Take it, Judith.
Okay. Well, thank you. In your introduction to me, you mentioned that I was born in England, in Brighton, during the last days of World War II. I was born in Brighton, and there was a lot of bombing, and I could never figure out quite why my parents didn't send me to a safe place in the country, as lots of other parents did, but I survived. And so I guess this poem, which is the first in my most recent book called The Conversation, this poem harks back to those origins. My world. Tangled like tumbleweed, barbed wire scrolls across the top of the beach. Bombs lie buried in shingle, waiting for a disobedient child to crawl through and trigger an explosion. Obedience equals life in 44. Glass, flesh, brick, smash and tear and fly through smutty air. It's a female, bustling world, this house where I'm born, under the left-handed full-mead moon of July. Her sinister light floods the streets. Her fingers probe the shells of crumpled homes. Bathed in her glory, old men on roofs and women driving Red Cross cars go about their work, watching for planes, digging through rubble, dragging out the bleeding, wounded. This is my world. I have to learn to love it. So I guess we're...
Say the title of that one again.
It's called My World.
Ah, okay. Well then.
Oddly. So I guess we're with war here for a minute. There was an occasion when I was going to teach in Barcelona. Actually, it was in Barcelona, and then I was flying back to London. And I flew into London the day that the bombings happened, the 7th of July bombings in London. And so I spent a lot of time during my stay after that thinking about it, trying to write about it. And I ended up, oddly, writing a poem that was quite modeled on the famous W.H. Auden poem that's called September the 1st, 1939, where he's sitting in New York in a cafe thinking about the war that's coming. So I used a couple of lines from his poem as an epigraph, and I also refer to his poem a couple of times in the my poem. But if you know his work, you'll recognize it. If not, you can think I wrote it.
So it's either way works.
Either way works. It's called The London Bombs, and the epigraph reads, "The unmentionable odor of death offends the September night." W.H. Auden. "This time it's early July, and more than six decades have loosed a spate of speech where once grave tongues were tied. Death's on the lips of each smooth-talking TV head, projecting sincerest concern at the camera's red-hot eye. A rotten smell pervades the air. Only the dead can catch the spinning lie. Survivors, poxy with soot, stumble into the light. Photographers flash at the mask of a swaddled face, white like the bandaged invisible man, except that the left eye's covered, the right a mystery. One foot in front of the other, huddled into a stranger, she asks, 'What happened?' 'Don't worry, love,' he says. 'Hop into the van.' Deep in the earth, dig and sift and chase off rats in 110-degree heat. Up top, flowers, photos of lovers who'll never be found. Handbags, odd shoes, a wig, sunglasses, half-burned hats. Rumors swirl around as dust wafts from the feet of doctors, policemen, cats from the tunnel, triumphant crows. No good asking, 'Why do we never learn?' or 'What makes the young men suicidal?' No good bemoaning the hate afflicting not just the idle, the disenfranchised, the poor. Before each and every war, some poet has seen the signs and sat at a table, his cry crafted too soon or too late into useless, shapely lines. I watch a small brown dog trot past the yellow tape of the crime scene, cordoned off in front of the station. The shape of attention, the hopeful wag, the whiskery head cocked to one side, all tell a story of daily meeting and greeting. But now, with his front door locked, it's 'Buzz off, dog,' and 'Sorry,' he's joined the ranks of the waiting. The dense commuters come into some new kind of life, strap hangers said to be stoic, or brave, or merely numb. Which wrist veined like a leaf? Which muscled calf? Which ear will rip or burn in the thick of the next explosion? Fear is quiet. The human race hurtles through tunnels, its gaze averted in its bandaged face." That was, I was there for the few days after, and you know how the TV always gets one image from every war that's become iconic, and in that one it was a woman being helped out of the tunnel with her whole face bandaged and just one eye showing, and everybody knew that image.
Yeah. Some of them are so, I mean, I remember images from the late 60s and 70s from the Vietnam War. Yes. They're that striking, and they last. And, of course, they are repeated.
Well, it seemed like, on a slightly lighter note here, that maybe today was the day to give a little homage to Bob Dylan.
Yes, the Nobel man.
The Nobel man. So I do have a poem which has... is taken from a Bob Dylan lyric, which is the song Tangled Up in Blue. One of my favorites, although I find nobody else likes it as much as I do. I love that one.
It's pretty brilliant.
So the poem is called The 70s, Bob Dylan Tangled Up in Blue. You'd think we'd have been nothing but happy. Indeed, we often speak of those days with nostalgia. Oh, how we shouted and marched and slept in musty bags on the ground beside barbed wire, beside the soldiers who guarded the war machines. You'd think we'd recall striding, arms linked, along the simmering streets, donning our costumes of shocking certainty. You'd think those might be the happiest days of all, when change flew in from the west and further west, and blind belief raised its defiant fist inside the circle. The commune seethed as lonely latched onto lonely, blueprints for friendship thrown out with the trash. Sisterhood shone bright, but cast long shadows. And tangled up we were, the barbed wire piercing skin, as we loved and hated, kissed and ran. No wonder I secretly dreamed of being alone. I drove by myself to Wales. I parked at the farm. I climbed three fields. Sheep looked up from the grass and shook their matted fleece and grazed again. I sat in the slate-roofed shepherd's house, beside the stream, beside the dry stone wall, beside the rowan tree where one bird called, one voice alone, whistling praise to the world. Those were the days of clearest colors. Days I floated in heather's deep blue silence, breathing the dust of last night's smoky coal fire, wishing I were back with everyone else. All that ambivalence about living the activist life. Well, getting towards 3 years ago, I had a moment of, what do you call it, mortality, and had to have brain surgery, and was told that I was 3 hours from expiring, but I never felt like I was. I was still in touch with my inner life force, as you might say. But I wrote a few poems out of that experience, which of course is one that changes a person. So here's one that comes from that time. This is called The Wound, and it has an epigraph taken from Rumi. Rumi said, "The wound is a place where the light enters you." The wound. A small man with curly hair and a French accent sliced my skull on the right side vertically, opened a flap by which the irritating blood could leave my brain, and then closed it up again with screws and a line of staples that I still have, 42 of them in a plastic bag. Did the light enter me there? Is my head full of light now? Or has it spread all through my body, white light filling me all the way to the tips of my fingers and toes? And what exactly is this new light that slipped in through the open flap while the surgeon's delicate fingers held his instruments poised, pressed bone and skin into place, and closed up until inside that sudden opening, everything grew dark again? It's the light of seeing how snow and starched blue sky waited outside my window until I really saw them. Behind the trees, darkness forever touched by the kindness of light, and the shine of time passing at the speed it likes to pass, none of it wasted, even when I couldn't find the words. Mm-hmm.
I remember it well.
You remember it well?
I do.
The poem or the
experience? Well, the poem, certainly, but those days, yes.
Oh, yeah. Well, you were one of the good people who were there when I opened my eyes and was often there when I looked for a friend. I had a great, great circle of community, which I think was one of the reasons I survived it. So let me see. Let me read. Well, I guess another one from that time, because there's some time around that I can't remember. I lost some memory before and during that time. So this one is from that, and it's called Those Three Lost Days. Those three lost days are wandering somewhere in the tangled undergrowth of memory gone awry, lost from the orderly line of dates, usually marked by the faint flowering of a face glimpsed among dark lianas. So lost are they that the characters who, for all I know, made grand entrances into my room on the neurology ward left no impression at all, as if a forest swallowed them whole. Not just the leading lady, that worried visitor with her tulips, nor the extras, nurses holding pills in deftly moving hands, but the day itself wiped from the record I store inside my brain. Those days are gone forever, leaving three empty lots in which nettles may grow and anyone trespass. Tell me their stories, won't you? Describe how this friend shook at seeing me so close to death, how that one sat quietly holding my hand, and another talked cheerfully until I answered, not knowing my words were falling into the void where I might well have followed them myself. In the light of that possibility, 3 days doesn't seem much to lose. I've been too attached to my own memories. You were always there, sweetheart. Let me borrow yours.
I think we have time for one more.
Okay.
Yeah, before we enter the question and answer conversation period.
I'd like to read this one because it's sort of a poem about my very dedicated atheistic self. I haven't written much about that, but I'm always a little, I think this is a good place to do it. Let's put it that way. And so this is what that's about. This is called Not a Credo, and it's in three small parts. One distant woman and a dog on a 2-mile beach, low, warm sun in a streaky sky. Flock of sandpipers scurries in union. Gliding heron prowls above the bay. In front of my bench, a brown dumpling of a bird darts from boulders, making kissing sounds. On the far side of the water, log trucks groan. This side, nearly all is quiet. Blue is everywhere, including inside me. They so diminish this who call it God, or even God's best work. 2. What is this God they second guess, argue about, fight in the name of? What great longing lurks in the breasts of humans that they must conjure a deity from forests where stands of trees are trunk and branch and leaf, not cathedrals of sacred heavy stone? Why the rules, the threats, the promises to lure the unsuspecting with virgins or angels sitting on clouds in the sky, 100 distractions from the business of dying? 3. Few dare to reject the tricks pulled off by the wizard in his cloak, the priest in his gown, rabbi, imam, pious clown. But where, amid all that pomp, is the hiding place of conscience? The backbone of one life glows and is soon snuffed out. No fuss, no ascension, no bribery at the gate. The light, the incredible light of every day is followed, not by darkness, nor even silence, but lo and behold, the greatest emptiness emptied. I don't often read that one.
I was going to say, I don't think I've ever heard you read that one at a reading.
I don't. It's funny. Yeah. I mean, all the things through my life that I've been self-conscious about, reading lesbian poems and this and that and the other, and suddenly here I am coming out as a non-believer in this country where being a non-believer is
serious business.
Serious business, yes.
Yeah. Yeah. More and more in this time. Yeah.
Yes.
Well, thank you very much indeed for reading to us.
You're welcome.
Now, of course, I have questions.
You always have questions,
I always
Judith
have questions. Well, you're not without questions yourself, Judith.
This is true.
All right. So I'm going to start with one of my favorites that I've asked, I think, everyone so far on the show. Maybe I won't do it every time.
That's very competitive making.
Oh, no, not like that. Not like
okay,
that.
Okay, we'll have to come up with a better answer than last time.
Au contraire.
Au contraire. Okay.
I like to cite a few folks. Many people think, including some poets, that poetry is by definition autobiography. And that the I is, you know, when someone says I in a poem, that it's definitely the poet. The folks I like to quote on this subject are Sterling A. Brown, major player in the Harlem Renaissance, born in 1901, who said, "Poetry is not self-expression. The I is a dramatic I." And then 50 years later, well, born 50 years later, speaking or writing even later than that, Andrew Hudgens, not an inconsequential thinker about poetry, says, "The speakers in poems are not real people. They are all creations of the writer, aspects of the writer's mind. Even when I," this is to say I myself, Andrew Hudgens, "even when I try as hard as I can to write as myself, I know that the I speaking is a persona, a subset of myself, some part that cannot hold the entirety of my experiences, my understandings, my ambivalences." And I read an article not long after I had seized these two guys and was going to use them as my examples. I discovered that Adrienne Rich heartily endorsed this very opinion. So those three serious thinkers and writers, they think that. We all think many things. What do you think? What do you think about this?
What do I think about it? Well, I think that there are poems that are actually real persona poems. I mean, in this book that I was reading from, I have one, I wish I'd read it now, which is written in the voice of Martha in 1630, who you know, has a really hard time, and it's a good feminist poem, but it's definitely not me. She gets punished with putting a bit through her mouth and a bridle. It's a terrible thing. And I have a few persona poems, one in the voice of the horse I had when I was a child, you know, which is definitely not me too. But I think when I'm writing more as if I'm myself, that I also have to create a persona. So I kind of agree with them that, and I think this is true because I thought a lot about memoir and I write memoir too, that when you write a memoir, which is clearly, in a sense, the I is you, the writer, but at the same time, you are creating a character of yourself to tell that particular story. And in the poem, I think that's true too. I mean, you are... the eye on the page in the poem is a kind of version of yourself, but it's a character that you create to tell that poem, to narrate that poem. And I find it somewhat irritating when people come up to me and think that everything I've written in a poem is truth.
Fact.
You know, it's fact.
Fact, yes.
I remember back in, I think, my first book or maybe my second book, I wrote a poem about my sister and I going to visit my parents' graves, driving down the coast of Spain. And some woman at a reading once came up to me and said, "And how are you and your sister getting along now?" And I thought, well, you know, you don't need to believe everything in that poem. But, you know, it's dangerous to assume that everything is autobiographical, although, of course, everything comes from the life we've lived.
Yes, both things are true at once. I definitely agree. And I also think that it's actually, even if we wanted to, in prose, as in a memoir, or in poetry, to replicate reality. You know, it's you can't do that. And on the other side, we're making art here, you know?
That was the word that was just floating through my mind.
Yeah.
Art.
Yes. Yes, this is art. We're not, this is not some kind of attempt to, all right, here's real life, and then, bam, here's real life again, but written out on a page. No, that's not the goal.
It's not like we walk around with a tape recorder and then transcribe real life.
Yeah.
No.
Now that's neither the method nor the goal.
No.
Not
the goal
desired.
Is to transform it into art.
Indeed. Transformation. That's, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's the deal. So, all right. Another one, as with the poem of my own that I opened the show with, another one that I have to ask, a sort of classic question. Thoughts in any order of any sort about writing poetry for and about what is called political thinking and feeling. One of the things I realized years ago was that the United States is a place, even now, although a little bit less so, but is possibly the only place on this earth where people don't think that's supposed to be part of the writing that is art, as we were just discussing. Mm. Whereas in every other country, people think, well, yeah, that's part of our lives.
Exactly. And then the poets that write the best political stuff get made into ministers and run the country and
stuff. Exactly. Yes. Not here.
No, not here.
We don't do that. Well, we haven't done that yet. Let's put it that way. Anyway, so you see where I'm going with this. Any thoughts, especially right now in this moment, which is so acute, not to say terrifying and going down that road. What are your thoughts in 2016 about what it means to make art that includes quite consciously and deliberately that which is political?
I find it hard to do because if I think to myself, I really ought to write something about the state of the world, it's not art. You know, I can't find the way into the art of that. But in fact, when I look through the work that I've produced, there is a percentage of it, perhaps a smallish percentage, that is political and came out of a particular time because it came to me, not because I looked for it. And I admire poets who have been commentators on the state of the world. Some of them, I think, are really wonderful. I've never been able to do that, but I always feel like, in some part of me, feels like I should, and then I can't. So it doesn't work that way.
No. Yeah, the should and the ought kill it,
yeah.
Whether it's political or some other,
right.
You know, this is what is to be done. It's all over once that's the impulse or the thinking.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
And I tend to write a lot about the past. And so I think, you know, occasionally I've written things like about Virginia Woolf or things about feminism that I knew in the 70s. And in that mode, politics creeps into it. And I like that it mm-hmm. does, because it's like who I was and who I am. But it seems to be not about now. I don't seem to be able to write politically about now, mm-hmm. although I have very strong feelings about now,
indeed,
I'm sure many of us do.
Yes, it's hard not to in these times. Yeah. Another one of my questions I like to hear what other people think about. Why do you think poetry so often still in the United States is considered esoteric? And that the majority of the people don't know it, they're afraid of it, they think it's something for a library shelf or a tiny minority of the folks. At the same time, this is the part that's so puzzling to me, at the same time that everybody comes up with it, you know? I mean, we grow up, whether it's Mother Goose or Sesame Street or any number of other sources, we grow up with poetry in our ears from the tiniest sizes and earliest ages, and people use it at birthdays and other kinds of major personal experiences. And yet, there's this sense that, oh no, I one of my neighbors said to me recently, well, I don't really understand it. And I'm thinking, you are an intelligent person. I know you can read. What does that mean? So have you thought about this? Why is that happening? Why has it been happening? Anything along those lines?
Oh, I've got so many thoughts about that. When I first lived in Oregon, for about 11 years, I was a poet in the schools. So I traveled around the state and a little bit in Washington too, going for maybe 2 weeks at a time or 3 weeks at a time to a school, elementary schools, middle schools, which I didn't understand, and high schools. And I was the poet in residence. And one of the things that I understood from doing that, it was an amazing experience. I worked with kids, and the younger they were, the more receptive they were. They loved the poetry. They were not self-conscious. They hadn't been told that poetry was a weird thing or a sissy thing. The boys didn't mind doing it. You know, it was all that. But the teachers were, on the whole, very uncomfortable. They had to stay in the room with me when I was doing the class. And some of them were great. Some of them would actually write the assignment or do the prompt or do the poem. But a lot of them were very uncomfortable with it, and already had gotten to the point where they thought poetry was like beyond understanding. Mm-hmm. And that, I mean, clearly if they were teaching those kids, right, the kids aren't going to catch any kind of enthusiasm or excitement about how wonderful poetry is and how wonderfully plays with words and what a joyful and playful thing it can be. So that was one of the reasons. One of the reasons I think that that's true. I also think that there are many different strands of poetry. I mean, there's, you know, academic poetry, there's spoken poetry, slam poets, there's everything. And I just think that sometimes there are people who come to my readings by mistake, basically, who say, oh, I never liked poetry, but I really liked your poems. And so, and I say, why? And they say, well, because I understood them. You know, I was like, you know, if it's understandable, then it's great. But I think there are some poets who have become very popular, people like Mary Oliver, you know, who has a huge, huge following. And whatever one might say as a poet, you know, you like some of them, you don't like all of them. She's a great ambassador for poetry because yes, there is a whole world of people thinking, oh, it is for me after all. It's about something that I understand. And they're not too concerned about the structure of the poem. I mean, I like to read poems to people and I say, oh, this is a sestina. And they think, oh my God, that's one of those weird things that poets do, you know. But I think that, I don't know, it's that there are few people who find a way to get their work out into the world who are popular poets. And that's good, but there are very few of them. And there is not an avenue for most of us to reach a wider audience where people might decide that they love our work, like you and me, you know. Mm-hmm. So I have no more thoughts except that.
I think that the Mary Oliver example is striking because, unlike somebody who does sort of what I think of as greeting card verse, she's the real deal.
Yeah.
And she's got this fan base.
Yeah.
So yeah, incredibly valuable for all of us that Mary Oliver should have broken through in this way. Yeah, it's not
a different kind of glass ceiling, right?
Yeah, really, yes. There's a lot of ceilings, glass, tinfoil, etc., etc. Okay, you mentioned the sestina, that is to say you brought up, so to speak, the notion of form. And another question is, in terms of your practice, your procedure, do you think of yourself as, do you assign to yourself, I'm going to write a sestina, I'm going to write a villanelle, and or is there something that needs to be a poem and you think this one should be a villanelle, this one should be, you know what I'm saying?
I do.
How does that how does that process work in you, Judith?
Well, initially, many years ago, I'd say, you know, long time ago, I used to set myself those assignments. I used to say, I'll learn to write a sestina. I wrote you know, a lot of villanelles because I love that form. And at some point, it became so embedded in me that I was able to see when a poem was announcing itself that it might be a villanelle. And that was only because I knew the form so well. It wouldn't have done that otherwise. And I really think that until you actually grapple with the form, it's not likely that you will recognize that that's what it wants to be. Mm-hmm. I don't write in traditional forms that often anymore, but I have got a couple. I had a sestina that I wrote recently, and I love the practice of doing it. I mean, I'm a crossword puzzle doer, so I mean, mm-hmm. it's definitely somebody, I love the intricacy.
It's a great analogy, yeah.
Yeah, I love the intricacy and the challenge of it. I also have in this recent book that I have out, I have one poem that is a palindrome poem, which I love, the fact of that. And if you don't know what that is, just think about the palindrome. Mm-hmm. It starts one way and it goes back the other way. Mm-hmm. I don't think I have anything much else to say about that. I love forms. I like poets who write in forms. I'm a great fan of Maxine Cumin, who mm-hmm. I recently led a study group on. And who writes in form and very beautifully. And I tend to think, I mean, maybe this is my sort of crotchety old person thing, where I say that I think somebody who is a young aspiring poet would do well to become familiar with some of those forms. I think, after all, an aspiring composer of music would need to study the symphony and the forms that have come before. And an artist, you know, might want to be a very avant-garde, far-out modern artist, but at the same time needs to understand brushwork. And so I think that it's part of our job as poets to know how people have worked the craft in the past. And sometimes we choose to do it still.
Yes, indeed. Sometimes we choose to do it still. And the going back and forth between prose and poetry, you're one of the people who mm-hmm. does that. Mm-hmm. And some folks think this is anathema. No, no. There are people who say, I am a poet, or, oh, no, I couldn't begin to write poetry, etc. You're clearly not one of those people, nor am I. But what, again, it's about the impulse. And this is, you know, related to the question about form within poetry only. So is it that you're telling a kind of story that seems to you belongs in prose? For instance, one of the poems that you read in your reading tonight is a story. More than one, I should say.
Blood of Bombs, yeah.
Yeah,
that's
right.
A narrative poem.
Exactly. So why, how, and other questions of that nature, choose the lyric as opposed to the paragraph?
Well, let me start with that poem, because that is interesting. It took an epigraph from Auden, and I was thinking about Auden a lot when I tried to write that poem. I actually imitated the form of his poem completely. It's in 11 line stanzas, which his poem is, and it has a very irregular rhyme scheme, exactly like his. And so, in a sense, I was thinking if he could write about war in that form, and it's a particularly peculiar form. It's not really a form that's got a name. It's just his invention.
He created that form for that poem.
I thought, well, why don't I try that? And it turned out that it worked. So that was that. In terms of prose and poetry, I first started writing short memoirs because I was trying to write things in poems that were stories that didn't really fit in the poem. And I just tried to write prose. And I'm fairly confident writing prose. Nowadays, I think when something comes to me, very often the first few words will say if they want to be prose or poetry because of the rhythm of them. And if it's, I mean, the rhythm of a poem is the rhythm of a line, and the rhythm of prose is the rhythm of a sentence or a paragraph.
Mm-hmm.
And they're different rhythms.
They are indeed.
And usually, I mean, sometimes if I'm lucky, I can say, well, I can tell that this really wants to be longer. It wants to be prose. I don't know. I mean, otherwise, just listen to what's coming to you, I say.
Mm-hmm.
It knows better than I know.
Indeed. And I think that I think, for me too, the rhythm it has a lot to do with making the choice. Mm-hmm. What does this feel like, musically speaking, in terms of the music inside the body, inside the head, and the whole body, including the head. Yeah. Yeah.
It is joined.
Indeed. Right. It's all one thing. We have a few minutes left. I want to ask sort of classic questions for writers kind of thing at the end here. Just name for us some poets or poems that have been particularly, if you don't want to, believe me, we can go on. It's not that I don't have a whole list of questions here. But
it's just that question, when it's about who's your influences and what poems were important to you, I found at readings when somebody asked me that, I go completely blank. I can't remember a single poem I've ever read.
Even though there are millions.
Yes, of course. Yes. But I probably could, actually.
Sometimes I just say Shakespeare. Because it's true.
It's true.
It's absolutely true.
I mean, I actually last week had to have an MRI of my head, which means, I had to get in a machine and it goes bang, bang, bang.
The machine.
Mm-hmm. And I was thinking about Maxine Kumin, who broke her neck and had to have many of those. And in her book that she wrote about that experience, she said that one of the things that saved her was when she was in the MRI machine, she had enough poems memorized that she could recite the poems while the banging was going on. And so last week I had to have that. And so I did think about Maxine Kumin while I was in the machine. Mm-hmm. And there is at least one poem of hers that I think I can say, and I said as much as I could of it, about the morning swim. It's called Morning Swim, and it's in rhyming couplets, and it's about swimming in a lake. Mm-hmm. And it sort of goes to the rhythm of the hymn tune, Abide With Me. And in the poem, she talks about while she's swimming in the lake, she hums Abide With Me. And that was very useful because it wasn't a very long MRI and it took up a lot of the time.
Excellent.
So she's one of those persons who's been influential in my writing. Yeah. Of course, Adrienne Rich. Of course, I don't know, just Mimi Calvati has been important to me, really important. Mm-hmm. And I would say that the answer to that might be different at different times, but...
That sounds right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Everything changes and we're accumulating.
Right.
We are all
finding new poets a lot, too.
Indeed, yes.
That's always great.
People who weren't even born yet when I was first reading poetry, and people who were born hundreds of years ago, but I just hadn't met them yet. Yeah.
This is true.
Yeah.
It's a great big world of poetry.
What luck.
Yes.
Poetry
and... We won't run out.
No, I think not. Poetry and everything, which is why I... chose that as the title, because there's really no separation.
Right.
Yeah. So here's a last question for you. What are you reading right now?
Oh.
And what do you think of it?
Gosh.
Poetry or prose or both?
Gosh. Boy. What am I reading right now? I've got 3 books piled up waiting to be read, and I just... finished reading a book called The Underground Railroad by Colson White, who's sort of a popular writer. And I heard him interviewed several times and I thought, well, it sounds interesting. I put things on hold at the library and suddenly, quite astonishingly, they turn up. And that was one of those. And I read it in 2 days. It's a very interesting read, a good read. He has this notion of the Underground Railroad instead of the metaphorical Underground Railroad, which existed, as we know, but as a real Underground Railroad where the escaped slaves and these people had a system of getting to the North. And it's a pretty good read. I like that. So what else am I reading? What am I reading? I'm reading a book about, what is it called? It's by It's by a British poet, and it's about Marlowe and the whole Shakespeare business. And it's a long, long book-length narrative poem, which I love. I love book-length poems.
What an undertaking. I mean, the notion, I'm always impressed by book-length poems. Yes,
and I can't remember her name. Isn't that shocking? I know her, too. It's one of those things that I'll remember as soon as I walk out of the
room. I was just going to say, the minute we leave the studio, the name will pop up.
Anyway, but that's sort of a poetic.
So it's about the boys in competition thing about Marlowe and Shakespeare?
It's about the whole political world that they existed in, and it's very well done. I like it a lot. Sorry, I can't remember her name. I feel very bad about that, but
it's probably the only one that's current that does that. So people will be able to find it. Yeah.
I've also been reading. Am I out of time here?
No. Give us this third one, then we'll close.
Okay. Never mind what I've been reading. Let's close. Because there's just so many.
All right.
I don't know where I'm at with that.
Not a problem. I have the same experiences. I'm crazy in love with the system of interlibrary loan, as well as the calling for a book so that you tell the computer, I want this book sent to my local library.
Yep.
And then while you're just minding your own business, you get a little message saying, here it is.
I know.
I've loved libraries all my life. I remember as a child, the bookmobile. But this system is a source of enormous pleasure and satisfaction. I'm wildly grateful to librarians.
How are you managing? I just tried to put two books on reserve this morning, the two that I wanted, there were many by this author, but they were all electronic resources.
Oh, yeah. I prefer actual books.
I like a real book, and I had to go like 20 down until I found that they did have one book.
They have a paper book.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's annoying to me.
Yeah. It is annoying. It's not annoying to the people who want the e-books, but for you and me, it's annoying. Yes. You and me and a few others. Yeah. All right. Well, thank you so much.
Well, it's fun to be here with you.
It's fun. Yeah, it is fun. This is part of, this is what I like about doing this show. This is the beginning. And it's not like I'm going to do this for 100 years, but for however long I do it, it's a lot about this.
You might as well.
Oh, yes, right. Next month's Poetry and Everything will air on November 8th, which is right after the Eating a Lot of Turkey weekend. Probably even the leftovers will be gone by then. And you can listen while the program is airing. And this is, of course, true with the one we're talking to you from right now. Or as long as the web exists, you can listen anytime from anywhere on the whole planet.
Just watch out for the Russians.
Do you remember that old movie, The Russians Are Coming, The Russians Are Coming?
No.
It was very funny and charming. In any case, so we're back to that. We're back to that. Oh, it's the Russians again. Thanks for listening, folks. Support your local independent bookstores, your independent reading series, and independent community radio. Good night.